It's time for Tommy's Holiday Camp.
Oh, yes. Welcome, everybody. This is Arnaldo, your host of Tommy's Holiday Camp, every Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. on wonderful Cowes Radio 107.3 FM or www.kows.fm, coming to you from lugubrious downtown Occidental. It's a little rainy out here, so be very careful on the roads. It's dark and leafy and things are dropping, so be careful. And we'll have an excellent show tonight, if I may say so myself. I'm saying it. And, well, it's about a very serious subject, obviously, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and specifically zooming in on the illegal settlements and actually the settlements in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. So with that, I have Lois Perlman in the studio here.
Good evening.
And I have Deppen Weber.
Hello.
And I also, have Therese Woolworth.
Hi.
Okay, so and now we'll be joined in about 15 minutes by Professor Stephen Zunes, who is an expert on the Middle East, and we'll be talking with him all together. So, leading up to that, first of all, the three of you, I know you formed the North Coast Coalition for Palestinian Support fairly recently. What made you do that, first of all?
Oh, we're looking at each other. there was an attack on a flotilla of ships headed for Gaza to break the blockade against Gaza. And seven people were killed by Israel. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Nine people were killed by the Israeli army in that attack. They were, of course, not soldiers. They were peacefully sailing along to bring material aid to Gaza.
Right.
And I guess while all of us have been working on this issue, certainly Therese forever and me for some time and Deppen probably for some time, that was kind of a watershed moment.
Yeah.
And we said, okay, actually, we didn't say that. It was Mary Moore from Camp Meeker who said that. She called up Therese and me and a few other people, and she got us together, and we went to visit our congresswoman, and we formed a group. And we have been meeting, some of us, ever since.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've taken some actions, not just meeting.
Well, we're in the process of trying to figure out how to form as a group and begin a process that hopefully will alleviate some of the suffering that some of the Palestinians or many of the Palestinians experience under occupation. And there is a movement called BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanction, and that's the group that we belong to. So we're still trying to find our way, the best way to gain allies in this struggle. So.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Yes. And perhaps maybe give some of your background, and then we can speak to Deppen and Lois as well.
Okay, well,
how you come to this.
I am a native Palestinian. I was born in Jerusalem. On my birth certificate, it says Jerusalem, Palestine, even though that country doesn't exist and hasn't since 1948.
Right.
And so shortly after my birth, the United Nations decided to divide Palestine, the country of my birth, in half and give a little bit over half to a new Jewish state. And, of course, war erupted, you know, and people got caught, civilians got caught in the struggle, and there's a lot of bloodshed. And my parents fled, actually, mm-hmm. picked us up, but as so many other, 750,000 Palestinians actually fled or were driven out at the point of a gun, some of them. For us, it was, my father was a witness to a massacre, and he was really traumatized, so much so that he said, we need to leave, at least until things settle down a little.
Yeah.
So we
How many stayed in Israel?
Pardon me?
How many Palestinian Arabs stayed in Israel after...
The majority of the Palestinians left, fled, or were driven out. I would say, let's see, I should know this, but probably almost a million people stayed, you know, in the part that was supposed to become Palestine, which it never did. Mm. So my family fled to Jordan, which is, you know, what I remember as a child. That's where we spent the first 10 years of my life before coming to America.
Right.
So...
And, first 10 years. So, okay, so you missed a lot of those wars that went on at that time.
Well, they were just a hop and a skip away, you know, and there were a lot of Palestinians in Jordan. So, in fact, today the majority of the people who live in Jordan are Palestinian. So, but at that time, we were removed from the direct connection to the conflict. So.
Right, right.
But, you know, nobody likes refugees, so it was not an easy place to be. And especially poor refugees who, you know, had to start all over again, you know.
So. And in camps or home, did
actually,
people take them in, or how did that work?
The most people ended up, the United Nations, when it looked like it wasn't going to resolve, the conflict wasn't going to get resolved quickly, the United Nations again stepped in and built so-called temporary camps for people. We were lucky because we had some connections in Jordan, because my dad was a teacher, and he taught for the Patriarchate of Jerusalem, and so they actually did give him a job in Jordan eventually, you know, and we found housing. So I never lived in a camp through the grace of God.
Yeah.
You know, I could have been there, you know. But they lived in camps, you know. First, there were tents, you know, and then as things looked like they weren't going to be resolved very quickly, they became, you know, more concrete. You know, like housing, very, very poor.
More permanent semi-permanent
housing.
Yeah.
Right, right. And you know, if you've been to a refugee camp, which I was in 2007, it's not a good place to be. It's not a good place for a child to be growing up. It's very sad. Yeah. It's very sad. Some of those people still hold on to keys for their homes that they think that they're going to get some kind of, you know, recompense or something for. So
what's their only connection, you know, just something that
it's a symbol of their hope, you know, that something, you know, so that justice will be meted out to them. So
a lot to talk about. Devon Weber, now you were just there in Palestine.
I took a trip with a group called Interfaith Peace Builders. They're based in Washington, D.C., and there were, I think, 23 members in the group from all over the country, one from Canada. We were over there the first 2 weeks of November. I just got back Sunday. And we met with a lot of organizations over there, a lot of experts. We met with Jeff Halper from Israeli Council Against Housing Demolition, and he showed us around neighborhoods inside the Green Line that are being demolished.
So it's just going... Before your very eyes, it's happening.
It was right there. Yeah. It was talking to people who whose homes are in jeopardy of being demolished, who have been thrown out by settlers, whose farms were whose farmland was being reduced in size because of settlements the Israeli government's paying for. It was a very moving experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you were in the paper a couple of days ago because you did something pretty dramatic. You basically quit your job because it was too much defense-related work, and it really, your conscience basically didn't allow you to continue. That's quite something in these days.
No, if I could, when I started that job, I didn't think of the company as being related to the military. They do a lot of work in the cell phone industry, and that was most of their business. And the longer I worked there, well, they went through some changes in the last decade. They began to work with Raytheon, you know, the weapons manufacturer, a lot more. I think this was in the article, but I learned that in 2005 they were doing 11% aerospace defense, and part of that was the new Raytheon business they they had picked up. And in 2010, the group based in Sonoma County was doing 24% of its budget was aerospace defense, which included selling to the Israeli military. And, you know, when I looked at those numbers, I just couldn't do it anymore. So I left.
Well, I have to give that to you. That's very, very brave. I really do. Well done. Yeah. And Lois, what is your background? And also, perhaps at the end, we're going to maybe read that little history.
When it seems appropriate.
Yeah, I think that would be good, because I'll call Stephen Zunez pretty soon after that.
Okay. So my background, I was a reporter for several smaller newspapers here in Sonoma County, most notably for 5 years for the Argus Courier in Petaluma. And I still freelance. I actually have a story in the Bohemian this week, which has nothing to do with any of these subjects whatsoever.
Tell us what it's about.
It's about Sutter Hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And the lawsuit against the county for approval of Sutter. And a lawsuit against Sutter in Marin County for another reason. So my background, I'm an actor, a singer. I've been doing an awful lot of that lately, and a lot less newspaper work. I also have had a couple of shows on KGGV, your sister station.
That's right.
And I went to Palestine and Israel in 2004. With Global Exchange, and had some of the same experiences that Deppin had. I didn't pick olives. We really just went around and around, and we were there for a week and 2 weeks maybe, and then I stayed a little longer on my own and spent some of that time in Tel Aviv.
Okay.
And you don't have to be there for very long to see what's going on, especially if you have guides pointing it out to you. And we got to meet all sorts of people, Jeff Halper and lots of their the Gush Shalom, which is a peace Israeli peace group in Tel Aviv.
Okay.
And other peace and justice groups in Israel, and we spent quite a bit of time in Palestine. And I fell in love with the old city. And
wow, yeah.
Okay, so that's my background.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give Stephen Zunez a call. Put on some music whilst I'm doing that.
Okay.
And what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? How's that? Well, we're back again on Cows Radio. This is Arnaldo, host of Tommy's Holiday Camp. Phone number in the studio, 874-1073. And I have on the phone now Professor Stephen Zunez. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Can you hear okay?
Sounds good.
Oh, great. So we've got, five of us sitting around. Lois just did a brief history of Zionism and just leading up to the whole thing, what's caused this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're professor of politics and international studies and chair of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And to have attained that, you must have done some pretty heavy-duty studying.
Yeah, and I spent a fair amount of time in Israel and Palestine as well. And so the bulk of my training is on international law, human rights, U.S. policy, particularly as it pertains to the Middle East.
And do you visit there regularly?
Yeah. It's been a couple of years, but yes. And it's amazing over the years to see how the settlements have grown and grown and grown. And now they even have these special roads connecting them, and you can and very quickly there for Jews only and those who get official approval to travel can be on these roads and go into these settlements. It really is an apartheid type of situation.
Yes, that is just shocking. A totally separate network of roads.
Exactly. I mean, they tunnel through mountains and put bridges over valleys, to avoid, contact with Palestinian areas. Our tax dollars at work.
That's right. We spend, $3 billion a year, something like that?
Right.
Do we ever see an accounting of that?
Israel's the only country where the money goes directly to the international treasury, pretty much, to spend as they will. Most countries where we give foreign aid, every penny we say you have to buy, say, X amount of American wheat shipped by on American ships et cetera. A lot of restrictions. But the economic aid actually to Israel has dropped off considerably in recent years. It's now mostly military aid.
Okay, and well, we have here, Devon has just come back from the West Bank, and so we have some current information going on here. And now, globally, obviously going up to the top level, what happened with the freeze, with Obama's freeze and that whole process that was happening?
Well, basically, it was Israel has several times promised a settlement freeze, going all the way back to the Camp David Agreement in 1978 with the United States and Egypt, in return for a $10 billion loan guarantee back in 1992. And they again agreed to a freeze as part of the roadmap that they signed on to back in 2005. But each time they've broken that agreement and resumed settlements, and this is despite that every single settlement there is a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits any occupying power from transporting any parts of its civilian population onto territory seized by military force. It's also in violation of less than five UN Security Council resolutions calling them to cease building settlements and to withdraw from the ones they'd already built, as well as a landmark 2004 ruling by the International Court of Justice that confirms the illegality of all these Israeli settlements. But Obama is refusing to call on Israel to withdraw from these settlements as required by international law. All he's asking them to do is to not build any more. So far the Israelis don't seem to be going along with that.
Yeah, what is the their legal justification for that? What turns it for them?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Some of the more zealous settlers say it's because God promised it to them in Genesis 15, and any temporal law, like the Fourth Geneva Convention, doesn't apply to a higher law.
Okay. That's a hard one to fight.
The original idea is that we need these settlements for security to have a frontal line from attacks by Arab states, but Jordan and Egypt, major states that would border where they're building the settlements, agreed to peace a long time ago, and they weren't. And they were defeating the purpose of a buffer zone by moving into them in the first place. But also some say, it's not really, despite what the United Nations, everybody says, it's not really occupied territory because Jordan's control of the area pre-67 was rather dubious as well. But this doesn't, for example, explain the Israeli settlements in the occupied Golan Heights, which is indisputably part of Syria. So Even if you were to buy the questionable status of the West Bank, though, of course, again, the World Court and the UN and pretty much everybody else says, indeed, this is territory under belligerent occupation, and therefore it does apply to the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Right, and well, that's it. You know, there we are. We're at a presidential level. They're talking or not talking, and then, but here down on the streets, people are struggling. Devon was showing us some demonstrations that are going on nearly every day there. You know, how does that equate? You know, where nothing is happening to the groundswell that seems to be happening.
I mean, for years, we always talked about, well, if only the Palestinians use nonviolence, but they have been using, thousands and thousands have been participating in nonviolent resistance against the settlements and the separation wall. But, you know, the leaders have been arrested, and there are several in jail right now with long sentences for purely nonviolent organizing, disrupting the public order or something to that effect. There's a wonderful new documentary out called Boudreaux, which talks about the nonviolent campaign against the wall in the, near that town. But there's been quite a bit of this going on for some time. And, you know, it's like the hardliners, the extremists say, you know, nonviolence doesn't work. And they're saying, yeah, really, but let's see. Let's really see if this nonviolent action can work in stopping the settlements and the wall and the continued occupation of so much of our best land. But so far, with a few minor successes like Boudreaux, it's not been working. And so my fear is, unless President Obama is willing to say to the Israelis, "You got to stop this, or we're going to cut off aid, or you know, use some tough love or something to utilize the enormous amount of leverage the United States has in Israel if we decide to use it." But unless and until the United States does that, it's only going to encourage the extremists and make Hamas and some of the more radical groups more powerful and more influential.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, join in any time, Therese, Lois, Deppen. Yeah, it's always the opposite we're going towards, it seems. We never seem to be going to an actual solution. We seem to be always pushing further away from it.
Yeah, absolutely. What is disturbing to me is that the leaders of the nonviolent movement are in jail. I mean,
the nonviolent movement are in jail.
What's that about? I mean, clearly what it says to me is that Israel is not the Israeli government. I mean, I'm sure there are lots of Israelis who are interested in keeping, you know, making peace and resolving the conflict. But it sounds to me like the Israeli government is not interested in a one-state solution, a two-state solution, any kind of solution. You know, and they're out to get all of Palestine without the Palestinians. I mean, that's what it looks like. That's what it feels like. That's what it looks like.
Yeah, when you're looking from outside and seeing what's happening.
And talking to people who've been there. And you know, I was there 3 years ago in 2007. I'll be going again in February. And it's unbelievable that this continues to go on and we continue to support it.
It's just a stalling tactic all the time. Then,
yeah,
is that how you see it, Stephen?
Very, very much so. Just creating facts on the ground, and the United States has been encouraging this. I mean, you know, there's been a whenever there's been an effort in Washington to try to put a little pressure on Israel to put on a freeze or whatever, you know, Congress has intervened. Both Democrats have done this too. Barbara Boxer, in fact, has authored two letters, dear colleague letters that she had, or she got some, you know, a couple dozen people to sign on, other senators, both Republicans and Democrats, to write both President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton, basically encouraging them to back off on putting pressure on Israel, and basically saying, you know, that. You know, effectively blame the Palestinians if they don't continue with the peace process, when the Palestinians know that the peace process is just going to drag on and on while the Israelis end up building more and more settlements.
Right.
And the thing is, it's like the United States has been big at punishing Palestinian radicals, but they seem to fail to reward the moderates. And as long as that policy is going to go on, it's just going to, again, encourage the extremists. So I should go back, actually, to mention that the Oslo Agreement basically said that these kind of changes on the ground were illegitimate, and Israel violated that. There are more than twice as many settlements now than there were at the signing of the Camp David, the Oslo Accord in 1993. And the Clinton administration just kept putting things off, saying, oh, this is a final status issue, what to do about the settlements. This is a final status issue, we've got to do all these other things first. And they kept building more and more settlements. And the Wye River Agreement, the U.S. actually started funding the settlements by helping to pay for these highways that I mentioned, the Jewish-only highways, and these increasing the fortifications of these illegal settlements, which puts the United States in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 465, which prohibits any member state from facilitating this kind of colonization effort. So, and meanwhile, the Democratic Party, then on its platform in 2004, says that you can't expect Israel to withdraw to its pre-67 borders, as UN Security Council Resolution 242 and all these said it had to, because of the demographic changes on the ground, namely the very illegal settlements that successive administrations have made possible. They have also vetoed or threatened to veto a whole number of UN Security Council resolutions that it would try to have enforced these previous resolutions. So really, the settlements aren't just the fault of a few Israeli extremists. It has been a policy that has essentially been facilitated and made possible by Barbara Boxer and other members of Congress, and both Bush and Clinton and previous administrations.
Well, it sounds like it's Jewish vote in America is what they're pandering to.
Not really. I mean, we allow settlements. The Indonesians to colonize, settle in the East Timor and in Morocco and Western Sahara. I mean, we're perfectly capable of supporting right wing allies invade, occupy, and colonize, neighboring nations without. We don't need an ethnic lobby to force them to do so. But I do think it does, and indeed Jewish opinion has never been more divided on this question. Yes. In fact, the majority of American Jews poll believe there should be a free zone settlement. So it's not the Jewish vote here. I think it has a lot more to do with the larger geostrategic view of the United States, that our allies can get away with certain things, and not just settlements, but nuclear weapons and bombing civilians and various human rights abuses that we wouldn't dare allow an adversarial nation to get away with.
Right, exactly.
And we wonder why a billion people, I don't exactly remember how many Muslims there are in the world, are upset with us. we wonder when we continue to do this, to support such an unjust situation.
Well, that's it. Yeah, just being one of the America being one of the few who do support.
Yes.
In that, against the rest of the world. So, how do we? Where does that leave us? Are we just stuck here and nobody can do anything? What's going to happen?
So here we come to boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Yeah, and this is a movement. Well, you know more about it, Therese, but it started some years ago in Europe.
Yes.
It's just taking hold here. There's a petition to get on the ballot in whenever, it says whatever election is after the March election, whatever general election is after the March election, an initiative that would require the retirement funds for state employees to divest themselves of investments in companies that do business with Israel in terms, I could actually read the exact language. It's not people who sell shampoo to Israel. It's about about military investments in military companies. So
that's
here
like
it Deppen says,
was saying that his company was connected with that. Yeah.
So it says, if successful, the initiative will appear on the next statewide ballot. And here's the actual language of it. Over $1.5 billion of California's public employees and teachers' retirement funds, that's PERS and, I don't know, STRS, are invested in companies such as those listed below, which provide materials for the construction or maintenance of Israeli settlements, including those in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So this is only related to the settlements. Or that provide military supplies and services to Israel. Okay, so it's the whole deal. These materials and supplies are used to destroy homes, separate families, maintain the blockade of Gaza, and contributed to the invasion and bombing of Gaza in 2008-2009. So this initiative, if it were ever to get on the ballot, and there are, I believe, two more months to gather signatures, or until the end of the year, perhaps. So that's only, a month and a half to gather signatures to get it on the ballot. And it... it's one thing that people are starting to do. I'm noticing there's I don't know if groundswell, but I guess it's a groundswell of people who are particularly involved in this boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which, by the way, worked really well in South Africa, didn't it? Yeah.
Right.
Another apartheid state.
Yeah.
I believe that this is the thing. It's not. We're not stuck.
Okay. Sorry, Stephen.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that I certainly support boycott, divestment, sanctions in terms of companies that are supporting the occupation. I think it's important to remember, though, that in South Africa, direct foreign investment was the major way the United States was backing South Africa. In terms of Israel, foreign direct investment is pretty far down the list, given the enormous military and economic and diplomatic support the United States gives to the Israeli government. And so I think it's also important that we really focus on changing that aspect, because if by some miracle we force these companies out, Congress would just increase aid to Israel by the same amount that Israel lost, you know? So until that happens. And the thing is what's really striking, this is particularly true in the L.A. area, actually, that you have these otherwise, you know, pretty progressive members of Congress who are liberals on a lot of issues, are very right-wing on this issue.
They're called PEPs, progressive, for Palestine.
And anyway, this is what bugs me. I'm not saying you should be single issue, and I'm not saying it's not necessary sometimes to vote for Democrats as a lesser evil or anything like that. But what really bugged me is that, you know, back in the 1980s, when you had there are some Democrats who supported Reagan's policy in Central America, and they would support unconditional aid despite all to the Contras in Salvador and Junta, despite all the civilians being killed. They trash the International Court of Justice for ruling against the United States in terms of aid to the Contras. They attacked Amnesty International and other reputable human rights groups and the UN as being biased, et cetera, et cetera. And the Democrats that did that were called Death Squad Democrats, and they're subject to quite a few protests, and progressive groups, you know, never endorsed them, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, what I just described about these Democrats in Central America, I could say about Barbara Boxer and Henry Waxman and Brad Sherman and Howard Berman and all
Feinstein,
these folks. Yet they are considered progressive. Barbara Boxer is named Progressive Hero of 2010 by the million-member Democracy for America, and called a progressive hero by Move On. And it's like, it's not like the pro-Israel lobby is so powerful. It's because the progressives are letting people get away with this kind of thing that we would not let them get away with on almost any other issue. If they took as bad a position in terms of human rights, international law, anti-war, whatever criteria would use anything. If they took this bad a position on almost anything else, there'd be protests and sit-ins and all this kind of stuff. People wouldn't be calling them progressive heroes. Why are the lives of Palestinians and Lebanese any less precious than Nicaraguans or Salvadorans or South Africans or anybody else?
Right. Very good point.
It's a very good question.
Yeah.
It's actually a question.
So do you, Stephen, do you think that... so much of this pressure on the legislators is really because of AIPAC and, you know, and their support or lack of support or their pressure on.
I think in terms of our overall policy, given what we history U.S. foreign policy in Southeast Asia, Latin America, Southern Africa, elsewhere, would be more or less the same, even if AIPAC didn't exist. But I think where AIPAC does have impact in some cases, and allied groups and political action committees and stuff, is that it has limited the debate somewhat. It has, you know, at least in Central America, you had more liberals speaking out against the policy, or East Timor, or South Africa, et cetera. And which we don't have. I mean, we have a few people up here in the Bay Area, you know, Sam Farr, Pete Stark, Barbara Lee, Lynn Woolsey, et cetera. But you say there are exceptions, but by and large, you have you have a surprising number of erstwhile liberals taking this position. I think, though, that it is in many ways overemphasizing AIPAC puts like-minded groups. Can be self-fulfilling, because I think that's one reason that a lot of mainstream liberal peace movement type people allow folks like Boxer and others to get away with this, because they say, oh, they can't help it, the lobby is so powerful, so we'll go endorse them and praise them and et cetera. Anyway, and again, it's been self-fulfilling, because if they're not going to hear pressure from the other direction, you know, what is their incentive? Of course they'll go the path of least resistance. And so that's why, though there's no question that there's a lobby out there that does have influence and has created something of a climate of intimidation on Capitol Hill. I think that it's important to remember that there's a lot of dissent, a lot of debate. Most Americans, in fact, most American Jews, are not nearly as far to the right as most Democrats are when it comes to Israel and Palestine. Hmm. And they need to feel the heat for that.
Right. Well, indeed. I mean, with the Israelis you speak about, where are they coming from now? You know, the everyday, more liberal Israelis. What are they seeing? What are they doing?
The peace movement there has had its ups and downs, and it's unfortunate. Part of U.S. policy has been, trying to exaggerate the threat. They blamed Arafat for the failure of the Camp David summit and summer 2000, and other things that we now know from the record were not true. There's been a big push to. Israelis are like anybody else. They have your right and your left, and you have the right wing in Israel that, for ideological or security or religious reasons, wants to, nationalist reasons, wants to, hold on, is not willing to make the necessary compromises for peace. You have those in the left who, for moral or pragmatic reasons, are willing to make the necessary compromises for peace. But most Israelis are in between, and history shows they tend to lean left when they feel pressure from the U.S. to compromise. They lean right when they get the idea they can just get away with whatever and don't have to suffer the consequences. Okay. And the policies under Bush and Clinton were to support the more hardline elements, and so Israeli public opinion moved to the right. And I think we need to recognize that there are all types there, that things are malleable. Peace movement is not as strong as it's been in some parts in the past, but it's stronger than it's been more recently. And while Israeli public opinion is moving somewhat to the right on some issues, and they have the most right-wing government in power now they ever have, there are plenty of Israelis that would love to have the United States be willing to use a little tough love. I mean, I remember an Israeli saying, whenever he hears an American saying, oh, we can't pressure Israel because Israel's our friend, he says, what do you do when a friend is drunk and is and heading towards his car with the keys in his hand? A friend says, take the keys away. The friend says, I will not let you hurt yourself or hurt others, because Israel's policies are self-defeating. They're making them less secure instead of more. And I think that's a fair analogy. Except I'd extend it to say that the United States is the bartender. We're pouring the stuff. We're the enabler. We're making
That's
it possible.
That's a good one.
Good description,
I just wanted to make a quick comment about the boycott, divestment, sanction movement. I don't believe that at this point any of us think that we're going to break the economy of Israel, nor do we even necessarily want to do that as it happened in South Africa. I believe it's more of an educational tool. And for that reason, if this initiative were on the ballot, whether people voted for it or not, they'd have to read it.
Right.
And then they'd get another point of view.
Yeah. Well said.
Good point. And maybe Therese can help with this. What's the dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians?
Oh, boy, yes. There is definitely dialogue going on. It's not, we don't hear about it as much, it seems to me. You know, we're trying to do some dialoguing here in this, in California, you know, in my own county here in Sonoma County. And there are non-Zionist Jews who are very open to dialogue. And, I mean, I used to have, years ago now, I used to have a Jewish-Palestinian women's group. And, there were three of us and three Palestinians and three Jewish women. And for months we, you know, had lunch together and you talked about our kids and everything else like women would do until I started realizing that, well, it was time. We have enough trust and love. I love those women. They were like sisters for me. And so I started talking about what happened to my family in 1948. And we were one of the lucky ones because we did not end up in a refugee camp. You know, and as soon as I started approaching that, they backed away. It was so disappointing to me. You know, I had some compassion for them because I felt like they were really stuck, and they just couldn't deal with it, and I wasn't one to help them. But it was quite an eye opener for me that they just, even with all the trust that we had built, they just really pulled away. They did not want to talk about that. So. And I'm sure that there's a lot of that going on in Israel. I mean, you know, my son has a Jewish friend who, about three years ago now, his Jewish friend went to Israel on one of those trips.
Birthright, I guess it was.
Yeah, and yeah. So he came back, and I had been there the previous year, and so when this young guy came back and we're having dinner at our house, I said to him, "Well, Todd, what'd you think of the wall?" And he said, "Wall? What wall?" I couldn't believe it.
Oh, dear.
He did not see the wall. That monstrous, obscene wall, and he didn't see it. So they're very protected.
Yes.
Very protected.
That's interesting. How do you see that, Stephen, in Israel? Are they really cocooned like that?
Most Israelis have to serve one time or another in the occupied territories, and there's a mandatory 3-year military conscription, and then you're in the reserves an average of 1 month a year until you're 50. This is both men and women. So I think Israelis have an idea of what's going on, but from the perspective of an occupier. And that's one reason Israeli opinion has moved to the right, is that you've had these two generations now that have grown up as occupiers, and they have, and to be an occupier, you have to somehow believe that you have some God-given or other right to occupy and oppress people and deny them the right of self-determination. That can, as the biblical phrase goes, harden your heart. And we see that we see that implication. Now, there are a lot of Israelis who are involved in dialogue. There are a lot of Israelis who take part in these protests on the West Bank. You have hundreds of really Israeli soldiers that go to jail for periods of time because while they're willing to serve in the Israeli army, within Israel, they refuse to serve in the occupied territories and are thereby punished. You have soldiers and former soldiers who have been going around to Israel and around the world, you know, showing photos and movies and other things of the oppression that's going on to raise awareness. So there is some effort to open people's eyes to the reality of the occupation.
Indeed. Now, on the other side of the coin, who are the players, the big players in Palestine in terms of politically? I mean, we know obviously Hamas and PLO, and who else are in there?
There is a growing civil society movement, which is impressive, especially people on the front lines and these nonviolent struggles. And there's a younger generation that doesn't identifies with neither the Islamic extremism of Hamas nor the kind of a corrupt bureaucratic old guard of Fatah, dominant PLO group. And so some of them operate within Fatah, within the youth wing. Others are independents. But there is a new generation coming up, which is working for more accountable leadership. But the problem is that there's plenty of critical things you can say about the Palestinian leadership and in various ways. But the thing is that even if they had the most responsible, democratic, transparent, every kind of political leader, leadership you would want, they are still only control a tiny amount of the land surrounded by Israeli occupation forces, which have hundreds of checkpoints and roadblocks between these tiny little autonomous areas that the Palestinians control. And I think it's important to note that there's a positive and negatives on both sides, that Israel is the occupying power, and even if we assume equal rights for both peoples for statehood and security, the fact is that the onus of compromise is on the occupying power, not the people under occupation. And this U.S. position that, the two sides need to work it out among themselves, ignores this gross asymmetry in power between the two.
Exactly. It is not equal. Right. Exactly. Very interesting point. And how do we get to that point of equality? I mean, really, where do we have to go for that? So the two sides can feel they are looking at each other equally. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that has to happen is the Palestinian people need to unite. Mm. And unless they unite, there really can't be real peace. So, and it seems to me that the powers that be are doing their utmost, their best, to keep them divided and separate. Mm. So, and that's really, really unfortunate. It's very unfortunate because I don't think there's any possibility of peace if the Palestinian people are not united as one.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. I mean, we've got you got the Gaza Strip and you got the the West Bank territories, and they're basically controlled by two different factors of Palestinians. It sort of like goes back to the old Pakistan Bangladesh thing almost, isn't it? It's where they're separated by two countries, separated mm-hmm. by distance. Right. That must be very strange. I mean, how do those two areas relate to each other?
Well both. I mean, eventually, if there is a Palestinian state, it would include the West Bank and Gaza, and there would presumably be a high-speed rail line or a 40-mile or a highway, kind of like the roads that connect to West Germany to West Berlin. Mm. It's only 40 miles, where there are no entries or exits, but there could be freedom of movement. So that kind of separation in terms of future Palestinian state is not a problem. The problem, of course, is that the United States has been very clear that they will not allow any kind of a compromised coalition government, because the United States says that if even one member of if the Palestinian Authority included even one member of Hamas in their cabinet or anything like that, they would cut off all funding for development programs. They would keep the Palestinians out of the peace process, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, unless the Hamas as a group came out and endorsed Israel's right to exist and renounced any kind of violence and agreed to all previous agreements with the Palestinian Authority, et cetera, et cetera. Interestingly, though, the majority of the current Israeli cabinet, including the Foreign Minister's Party, are on record opposing the Palestinians' right to exist, certainly aren't about to stop the violence, and are publicly in opposition to a number of the modest compromises Israel has made already. So in other words, we're having much, much, much higher standards on the Palestinians about what their government looks like than we do on Israel, and this is preventing any kind of compromise that could get some of the more moderate Hamas people into the process and have a viable, unified government so the peace process could move forward.
Again, it's that pushing away. It's just doing the opposite way. It is.
Is what it is. It's just plain old insanity.
You know, that from 30 and 40 years of the whole Hamas thing is just so locked into American foreign policy, it seems, that you have to oppose them at all levels, it seems.
Well, it's a double standard he's talking about, that Israel can do no wrong and Palestine can do no right, it seems to me, no matter who does what. And we're, if Palestine makes, I mean, they lob a rocket, that becomes a horrible incident. And if Israel is, as they are in Gaza, shooting into the night every night and lobbing rockets on a fairly regular basis and sometimes from airplanes, that's okay because they're protecting themselves. I mean, don't the Palestinians have a right to protect themselves? They do under UN. They have a right to protect themselves.
Yeah.
And the right to resist an occupation. I mean, I think that's a right that people just as human beings, if we are occupied, if we are oppressed, that we have that God-given right to resist, you know, the oppression. And so when they do resist, and sometimes it doesn't look pretty, I'm you know, with the violence, I'm against the violence.
Well, certainly, so-called suicide bombings, it's horrendous.
But if there was no occupation, there wouldn't be a need to resist.
Right.
You know, so it's so clear, it seems to me, clear to me, that the occupation is really the source of all, the conflict and the violence and the craziness that continues now for, 40 some years?
Yeah.
You know, so...
When was the first Intifada? That was... 30
Intifada was in 87, I believe, wasn't it? Yeah, I think it was in 87, the first Intifada, the end of 87.
So, yeah, it's not as if time has helped.
No. Well, I really do believe that the program, you know, and Ilan Pappé says this in his book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, that it's been the program, you know, from the very beginning, that they seem to be after all of Palestine, without preferably without the Palestinians, and you know, when you look at it just objectively, I mean, it seems to be that's the course, you know, inch by inch, you know, foot by foot, and all through the years. And I don't know if you've seen that little, I should have brought one, that little card that shows. Wonderful graphic that shows how Palestine has gotten less and less, and you know, before 1948, and then 48, and then 67, and you know how it's being eaten up.
Right.
So that seems to be what the plan is, and what is actually happening. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, what is on the table for a Palestinian state? You know, what are the boundaries?
Well, that's what the debate is. And let's just remember that in the Oslo Accords, the Palestinians agreed to grant Israel 78% of Palestine. The part that was Israel pre the June 67 war. And so we're fighting really over the issue right now is the fate over the remaining 22%. And the U.S. position has been, both sides need to compromise. And Palestinians say, we already compromised 78% of our country. And besides, the U.N. charter is really clear. No country can expand its territory by military force, which is what the remaining 22%, was under Israeli occupation.
Right.
So really, the debate is, will this be a viable Palestinian state? Now, most people agree that that there's no way that the Palestinians reasonably expect to accept less than that 22%, though some compromise could be made. And the Palestinians sound open to this, Israel can annex some swaths of territory near the old border where they have these huge housing developments and everything, but give the Palestinians the equivalent amount of what's now Israel. And make some kind of land swap of a few percent or something, but basically the Sharon plan, which was endorsed by President Bush and by a huge bipartisan majority of Congress, is that Palestinians would have a good deal less than 22%, but more importantly, that Israel would it would be divided into a whole series of tiny cantons surrounded by Israeli territory.
Mm.
And they'd have to go through Israel and various roadblocks and whatever to get from one part of these statelets to another. And that Israel would control the airspace, the water reserves, the movement between the parts of Palestine, between Palestine and other countries, things like that. I mean, it would not be a viable state as we think of a nation state.
Right.
It would be very much like the infamous Bantustans of apartheid South Africa.
Right, right, or Berlin, West Berlin. Interesting. It's setting it up to fail, really.
Very much so. Exactly.
Incredible. Whew. Well, this is Cows Radio, 107.3 FM, coming to you from downtown Occidental. We have Professor Stephen Zunez on the phone, Teresa Walrath in the studio, Deborah Weber, and Lois Perlman. And we're discussing the Israeli-Palestinian issue right now. And now, one of the things, are you okay, Stephen, for chatting?
Yeah, great. And just initially, let me mention, I was on the Occidental campus just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
My son was down there checking out the campus for next year.
Oh, well, that's Occidental in Southern California.
Oh, you're another Occidental.
Yeah, we're up in Sonoma County.
Oh, that was the town of Occidental. Okay,
yeah.
Yeah. I've been there, too.
All right. We're our own little city-state here, I think, as well. But now, one of the things that Teresa and Lois said in an article they recently put in the paper, they actually started a group called the North Coast Coalition for Palestinian Support. And one of the things that I didn't realize is that the Israelis are actually evicting Arab Israelis from their from within the Israeli borders.
Oh, yeah. There's increasing discrimination against the Palestinian minority within what is recognized as Israel. Legally, they are full citizens, but in fact, they're very much second-class citizens.
Hmm.
They certainly have more rights than Palestinians in the West Bank and areas of Israeli occupation. I consider the West Bank an apartheid-like situation. I don't consider Israel itself an apartheid state, but there's definitely discrimination. And under the current right-wing government, they've been discriminating even more. And it's around things about, for example, housing permits, allowing Jewish areas to encroach on historic Palestinian land, turning down permits for Palestinian towns to expand. So people, if they're, getting married and want to move out of their house, they have no place to live, essentially, and many are forced to emigrate. It is definitely a calculated policy to Judaize, or however you want to call it, parts of Israel that have a pretty sizable Palestinian minority.
Okay, back here with Professor Stephen Zunez and Lois Perlman here in the studio, Deborah Weber and Therese Walrath. Welcome back. That was Robin Williamson and Border Tango. We're talking about the Arab-Israeli issue, conflict, whatever you may want to call it. And now, Deppen was just recently there in the in the territories. Maybe you can let us know what it was like firsthand, walking where the Israelis are working on settlements.
I saw a lot of huge settlements within Palestinian territory in the West Bank, with, you know, the settler roads and you know, farmlands being taken. But I think the thing that struck me the most was the settlers throwing Palestinians out of their homes in places like Hebron and East Jerusalem. Cities within Palestinian territory where settlers, Israeli settlers, where foreign settlers, American settlers, young people in their 20s will come over there and physically throw people out of their homes. I met one family in East Jerusalem who had been in that home for, I think, 51 years or 56 years. And they were thrown from their home by these young American settlers with the backing of the Israeli military right there to make sure that they couldn't fight back. So
the military are there.
The military are there. They allow the private. I call them private because they're not military. Mm-hmm. They're Jewish settlers that feel that they have the right to this property because, for whatever reason, because God gave them the
Greater Israel, the whole Greater Israel thing, I suppose.
Right, right. Yeah. And so they will throw them out of their homes. The military will be there by the hundreds to make sure that the Palestinians cannot fight back, that they will just vacate their home, children, everyone. The home I was at, there were four generations living in the home that were basically thrown on the street, and settlers moved into their home and they couldn't do anything about it.
Do they bother with paperwork, or is it something that they just turn up and do it? They don't slap a piece of paper on the door, or
you just squat.
I think they say they have a paper from God is what they say. When they do things like that. You know, I think every case is different. Some people have Jordanian paperwork. Many don't. A lot of farmers have deeds that show much less property than they really owned, because when they first got the paperwork, they stated that they had less land because that way they had to pay less taxes. So it's coming back to bite them a little bit. But you know, it was in their family. It was their land for many years.
Right. Yeah. How do you see that, Stephen, playing out there?
Well, I mean, again, this would not be possible if the United States live up to its obligation to enforce international law that forbids this kind of colonization. Indeed, the 2004 decision by the International Court of Justice, which was passed unanimously except for the U.S. judge who descended largely on technicality. But anyway, this 15-member court basically, in saying that that it's about the Israel separation wall, and basically they said Israel has every right to build a wall or fence or whatever they want on their internationally recognized border, but they don't have a right to build it in somebody's else's country in occupied territory, as what's a clear annexation effort. It also pointed out again that these settlements, every one of them, in the occupied territory, so it was illegal, and this was indeed occupied territory. But one thing is very interesting. It reiterated that every signatory of the Fourth Geneva Convention and similar international treaties has an obligation to whatever reasonable, whatever is possible, to uphold and to enforce these standards, even on third countries such as Israel. And so, right. So in other words, legally, the United States has to put some kind of sanctions or whatever pressure, as do other countries. But the United States, of course, is the most is the one that could really make the difference. In fact, the only country really who could make the difference. So whenever people say, "Oh, what can we do to bring peace?" It's nothing that individual Americans can do on in terms of what the Israelis do or what the Palestinians do, but we can, in theory, influence what our government does, and our government is the only government, really. I mean, Israel, there cannot be really peace until Israel's willing to compromise on these issues,
right.
And Israel's not going to compromise unless the United States pressures Israel, too, and the U.S. government's not going to pressure Israel, too, until the American people, pressure our government to do so.
So, again, where are we left if that's the case? I mean, who is pushing it forward at high levels to make something really happen?
Again, the pressure's been just the opposite by Boxer and some of her Republican allies who have been putting pressure on Obama to stop even his rather tepid efforts to push him. So, I mean, I really hope that every listener on Monday will call Senator Boxer's office and say, "Hey, you just got reelected, and you got elected with a lot of progressive support. And people like us don't think you should support these repressive right-wing governments that violate international norms and invade and occupy and colonize neighboring countries and kill civilians and bomb them with cluster bombs and white phosphorus that we pay for our tax dollars, and let her hear about this."
Right. So really, it's grassroots.
Yes,
it's not coming from anywhere else, really.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very disturbing when you think of it, that you can't point to one ally, somebody to push it at those high levels. That's disastrous. Are there any Arab members of Congress who are working on this at all?
There are a number. There's a core of about 20 members of Congress. All but one or two are not Arab American. Mm. And then there are a number, about 20, 25, who are generally more moderate on this issue. But most of these people are not on the Foreign Relations Committee. Hmm. In fact, the Middle East subcommittee of the House of Representatives is dominated by the most right-wing Democrats on the issue. These are ally with the Likud party. And indeed, the Foreign Affairs Committee leadership in general, and people like Gary Ackerman and Howard Berman and the like, these are very right-wing. They'd be right-wing by Israeli standards. Mm. Now, can you imagine, again, back in the 1980s, if the Latin American subcommittee, the Democrats, were all pro-Contra and pro-Salvador and Junta, but somehow they get away with this when it comes to the Middle East. The one exception is Congressman Ellison from Minnesota, who is on the subcommittee. But because he's a junior member, he was only elected 2 years ago, and because the number of Democrats are going to be reduced on that committee because of the Republican victory, he's going to probably be no longer on it. So it's going to be so all the Democrats are going to be right wing, and then of course all the Republicans are also right wing. So no one in really. So again, though we have there are a few dozen people in Congress who are sympathetic. Dennis Kucinich and Barbara Lee and folks like that.
The usual suspects.
The problem is the people in the key committee assignments are among the most right-wing people there are.
Hmm. Oh dear! I thought there'd be some hope, some glimmer somewhere that would.
And there is. I mean, we have groups like J Street, which sees itself as a fairly mainstream Zionist organization, which it is, but it does identify with the peace movement, more moderate elements, they're allowing a little more political space, and people are starting to hear from members of Congress more. I talked about 40 or 50 members of Congress who are fairly moderate on this issue. Just a few years ago, there were maybe only 20. So this issue is getting a little more coverage, because we are finding places, especially in districts where there are liberal to moderate Democrats, and there's already an active peace community. People can, there are members of Congress that can indeed shift on this issue.
Hmm.
They just got to hear from people.
That's it. It's so really, yeah, it's up to us then.
And to hear it from a peace human rights perspective, not a, pro-Palestine, anti-Israel perspective, but a, hey, same reason we were concerned about Iraq, same reason we were concerned about Central America, same reason we were concerned about East Timor. This is a human rights issue. This is
absolutely
a justice issue. This is a peace issue. This is not, let's not get into these tired ideological arguments about the nature of Zionism or whatever. Let's just say, let's stop supporting repression anywhere.
Exactly.
I think that's what's happening among a lot of young Jewish people, that they're seeing that they can't support Israel because of they see what Israel's doing, a human rights issue, as you said, Stephen. So that, to me, is very hopeful. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me also that division is becoming wider and wider every day in the Jewish community, which, I would consider that a very positive thing, because people are thinking. If you want to be a friend of Israel, you have to think. You have to think about what the occupation, what this oppression is doing to Israelis. Forget about the Palestinians if you want to, but that deadly toll is heavier on the oppressor. That's what history tells us. Than more so than the oppressed. Even though the oppressed are very, it's pretty heavy on them too. But in the end, I think it's if this continues, Israel will just self-destruct. I as a Palestinian do not want to see that.
Mm.
They have a right to be there, but so do the Palestinians. Human beings have a right to be free and to live, in a secure environment, whether they're Palestinian or Israeli or American or whoever they are. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
It's getting, that's good, that there are. Young kids are. I mean, they're going on the internet. That you can see things immediately. There's a lot more just being shown, I suppose, now. So you can latch onto things that are happening.
I just saw a little. I don't know if anybody else saw it. A little YouTube video thing that somebody sent me about what happened in was it Louisiana where Netanyahu was.
Hmm.
He was giving a speech to everybody see that?
And
all those young kids, how brave. It was really very moving to me, because it takes a lot of courage to do that, especially I would think if you are Jewish, to stand up against other Jewish prominent Jewish people, and they're doing it. They are doing it, and it's spreading, and that to me is very hopeful.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And there is a big shift in a younger Jewish opinion that it's pretty pretty exciting. People are, when they're told, you have to choose between your progressive values and supporting the Israeli government, they're saying, we choose our progressive values. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And I think that's...
great.
That's important. In fact, I haven't, in terms of public opinion, with the exception of gay rights, I hardly seen any issue where attitude is so closely correlates with age. That generally, the younger you are, the more sympathetic you are to the Palestinian cause, and the older you are, the more sympathetic you are to the policy of the Israeli government. And just let me mention that I don't like to say people who support the Israeli government are pro-Israel, because again, ultimately, I think it's really bad for Israel. They are pro-Israel the same way that our policies in the 80s were pro-El Salvador, supporting right-wing militaristic government that is pursuing policies that could lead to the country's self-destruction. And we really need to get away from this kind of either-or mentality, and again, get back to the basic principles of human rights and international law that have mobilized campaigns on all sorts of issues, from Central America to South Africa to Vietnam to East Timor and beyond.
Yeah, there's been some successes. That's true. People power does has done some things. That's true. We can only hope. Well, thank you so much, Professor Stephen Zunes. I really appreciate you talking with us and giving us
my great pleasure, experience. And I encourage people to check out my website, stephenzunes.org. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N-Z-U-N-E-S. And I have articles in Israel-Palestine and a series of other issues as well.
You're fantastic. I'm a fan.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Guests in the studio, that's Lois Perlman, Deppen Weber, and Therese Walruth. So we were talking whilst we were just off the air there with the music. Now, Deppen, you were just there in the territories there, and we were talking about really what's happening there on the day-to-day basis of people's lives, and how do the Israelis, how are they acting there?
Well, we were chatting a little bit about Hebron, which yeah. made a real impression on me. Like many of the cities there, there's an old city, Hebron, very ancient streets and storefronts. And there's many markets in the old cities. Spices and clothing and, you know, everything you need to you know, sustain a community. And throughout all of Old City Hebron, the second story dwellings above these street markets have been taken over by militant settlers. And as Therese was saying, they're very, very abusive toward the Arabs.
So they're literally on top.
They're literally on top of the markets.
Okay.
They live up there. They've taken over the apartments above there. They throw things down. They throw their garbage down onto the Arabs. They throw sewer water down on them. They throw hard objects. People have been injured by things thrown down from there. And they do it very brazenly, very proudly, because they know that there are the IDF is there with towers watching every move that everyone makes, and they know that no one will ever fight back for fear of being shot with a tear gas canister or worse.
So, yeah, retaliation comes pretty quick then. If you make any complaints, is that...
You can make complaints, but it'll fall on deaf ears. And any kind of physical retaliation will be met with, you know, bullets.
Well, that's it. Now, the Israelis can walk around with weapons, but obviously Palestinians can't.
Palestinians are unarmed.
Yeah.
They're not allowed to have weapons. And in Hebron, which is an ancient town where the patriarchs are buried, you know, Abraham, Jacob, and Isaac, Isaac and Jacob, Sarah's there.
Yeah,
that's where the patriarchs. Okay, so. And the matriarchs. Okay, let's not leave the matriarchs out. But, it has been for decades predominantly in a Palestinian city of, I think it's about 150,000 people. And these militant settlers came in, and a few of them, it's like under 1,000, have come in to the middle of downtown, like Deppen was describing here, was explaining. And they have really taken over the downtown area. They have shut all of the shops. And I have, you know, when I was there 3 years ago, I actually, with my own eyes, I saw that the locks were welded shut. so that the merchants, the Palestinian merchants, don't even have access to their own shops. Mm-hmm. And of course, they've taken over the upper parts. You know, it's really an awful, awful situation. I mean, that was the place where I was actually afraid, because mm-hmm. there were so many armed, people, as well as a lot of. So not only are there a few hundred settlers, militant settlers, but there are also something like 1,500 Israeli soldiers to protect them.
Oh, even so, more than sure.
And it's just an unbelievable situation. Mm. Now you were there too, weren't you?
I was in Hebron. I was, but I wanted to mention something else, which is a totally absurd situation in the old city, which is of Jerusalem. Now Jerusalem, which is divided into a Jewish section, is it a Christian and a Muslim section?
There's an Armenian,
Yes. section.
Yes.
And in the Palestinian section, when I was there, this is 2004, and I believe it's still there. Sharon had a house there.
Oh, yes.
Mm. And there's a Jewish star on it. It's right in the middle of the Palestinian section. And there, I guess there were a few other Jewish Israelis living in the Palestinian section. In order for them to go to and from their homes, they had to have soldiers guarding them because they were in the wrong place.
Right.
You know, and it was absurd. I mean, it's like they're thumbing their nose. I mean, there's nothing to be gained by planting a house in the middle of there except to intimidate.
Well, they're making a statement that East
making
Jerusalem
a statement.
Is ours.
That's it, isn't
and
it? Nine-tenths of the law.
You all don't belong here. So
I mean, literally, there's nothing to be gained. So it's an act of intimidation.
Right, mm-hmm.
right.
By the most powerful people, as you were saying,
we can do anything we like.
Yes, yeah. It's really very disturbing what some of the settlers are doing. I was in a little town, a little Palestinian town in the West. Now we're talking about West Bank. We're not talking about Israel. And this little town, it's called Atwani, and there was a settlement on top of the hill. So here in the valley was this small Palestinian community that's been there. They're mostly agrarian, you know. They've been there for many, many years. And so this settlement now, it's like a rampart, you know, on top of this hill. And the children, in order to go to school, they have to go by the settlement. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to walk across, you know, the valley and then up the hill and then down, which is where the school is. And the settlers, it was so bad, they would throw rocks at the kids. I mean, these are children, you know, with their book bags and their little lunches trying to get to school. It was so bad that the International Solidarity Movement had to come in, the Peacemaker and different organizations had to come in and accompany these kids, you know, to school. And then those people were abused, and so then the military had to come in.
Sounds like the South of in America in the 60s, 50s and 60s.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and probably even worse. Mm. It's just, you know, those poor children, what they have to endure.
Well, that's it, isn't it? It goes down to people and what they're enduring. I mean, you know, we can talk about politics, but people living on those streets and in those farms, they've got to live with that.
Yes.
I mean, that's an incredible thing to bear. And to be peaceful and get on with their lives at the same time.
And the amazing thing for me is to see how, you know, we talk about, the hopelessness in the world, but the fact that there's so many people, I mean, I think of Rachel Corrie, you know, because she was part of that movement, a young woman who left here, a very comfortable life, to go and to witness, you know, to be with these poor, you know, suffering people. It gives me great hope that there are people in our world who are willing to leave the comforts of their home and to go and to be with the Palestinians. And there are also Israelis. There are also Israelis who are doing this. You know, there is a whole group of Israeli women who go out to the checkpoints to witness, to make sure that the, you know, when the Palestinians are trying to come through, that the soldiers are not abusing these people. And of course, you know, when the women, when the Israeli women are there, the soldiers are less likely to be abusive, you know. And so this kind of thing, you know, has no boundary. Yeah. You know, it's like part of the human heart that reaches out to others. And there are a lot of people who are doing that, you know, including Israeli people.
Great.
So that gives me hope, too.
It does. At least, yeah, exactly. That, yeah. Again, the grassroots, people just get fed up enough. You have to do something. Yeah,
and
sometimes
somebody,
you've got to step forward.
You talked about Jeff Halpern,
oh, yes.
Who is started the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition, right?
Mm.
And so, you know, when the Caterpillar, you know, U.S.-made Caterpillar
right.
comes and sent by the Israeli government and military to demolish a Palestinian home, you know, they chain, you know, they hear about it and they go out there and they chain themselves to the windows and then they get pulled away, you know, and sent, taken to prison. And the house gets demolished and Jeff and his crew go out there and try to build it up again with the family. And so there is that kind of thing happening.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, as long as it's not a Sisyphus thing, you know, you roll it up and it rolls back down all the time.
Well, sometimes you know, it feels very much like a Sisyphus thing, what I remember of Sisyphus.
Yeah. When I was there in 2004, and I'm assuming there are probably more groups, we met with many Israeli, what I wouldn't just call them peace groups, but peace and justice groups, Palestine support groups.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We met with Jeff Halper. There was a, I can't even think of the name of it, but it was a group of young people. That was Palestinian Jewish group together. And there's, of course, Gush Shalom, which is the old left guard in Tel Aviv, and they are a strong peace group. When I was there in 2004, they were still being very hesitant about going into the West Bank to participate in demonstrations. But as I... Just at the time I was there was when they were starting to make that movement. And now they very on a regular basis, those Israeli peace activists are going into the West Bank to stand with Palestinians when the soldiers come to cut down the olive trees or to take over pieces of land or farmland or whatever. And they're a small minority. That's the truth of it. But they exist.
They're doing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, you're talking about knocking things down and buildings and trees. Something Laura mentioned is what are the environmental consequences of the occupation and being... what are people living in? What is their lives like? Are they like living, you know, is it a very difficult situation? I mean, you know,
well, I mean,
water, sewage, life in general.
The first thing that comes to mind is that the wall, 26 foot high concrete wall for miles and miles and miles snaking into, you know, beyond the green line, taking, you know, the water, the best water and sources and agricultural, you know, water is very precious there.
Right.
And so they're after the water and the best agricultural land and really dividing families, you know, from each other and from their place of work or their school or their farms or their trees. When I was there in 2007, and this is the image that has really kept me going, whatever I do with this woman in mind. We were passing by in Talkurim, which is up in the north, and there was this woman sitting by this barbed wire fence with her daughter, you know, a young daughter, and she had a lot of plastic bags full of, you know, those soda bottles, but they were all filled with water, and then she had some vegetables, you know. And so I can speak some Arabic, and so I went up to her, and I asked her, you know, very kindly, you know, what she was doing. And she said she was waiting for the soldiers to come and open the gate so that she could go home. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, this fence, they call it the fence, but this barrier came right through and divided their town in half. And so every time she needs to go to the store, she has to wait for the soldier, which comes, you know, the military comes twice a day, you know, in the morning.
Oh my
goodness. And in the evening. And God help you if you miss that time, you know. Even if you have a medical emergency, you know, you can't get through.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I'm not kidding. I have a picture of this woman. And so I was just like, oh, my God, I can't believe this. So we went on, because I was with a group of people, and we were going somewhere. And about an hour later, we came back, and she was still sitting there. Still sitting there. It was like 6 o'clock in the evening. And she still needed to go home, and there was no soldier. And I have no idea if that soldier ever showed up that evening. Wow. Because I had to get back on the bus and get going with the group. And so the people's lives have been disrupted, radically disrupted.
Yeah.
You know, I can tell you story upon story of that. And I'm sure, Devin, you can too, because you were just there. You tell them about the olive, why you went and picked olives and all of that. Because this is olive harvest season.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I have a real good reason for that. I wanted to go, and it was olive season, and I took the trip. But it was great to meet. It was great to meet the farmers. You know, there's towns in the north where are built around olive farming, and talking about glimpses of hope. We visited the Canaan factory, which is a fair trade olive. The oil company. They're all over. You can get Canaan products at Whole Foods, Oliver's. I'm sure other markets in Sonoma County, but those are two.
Or directly from them.
Or directly.
Yeah.
From
the website.
And they've driven up the wholesale prices of olives. They have a brand new facility in it's near Jenin. I'm not sure what the name of the town is, but they're growing, they're expanding, and it's really good to see them thriving. And it just goes to show what the Palestinians can do when they're given a little room to breathe and to do what they know how to do. And it was a great experience. The farmers were just so welcoming. We stayed the night at, we all split up and stayed the night with different farmers, and just such a warm feeling and welcoming feeling from the people in the towns and the homes. And we sat out on the patio and drank tea and coffee till midnight, and all the people in the town stopped by and, you know, said hello, and it was wonderful. And all the kids in the neighborhood were going to college, and very well educated community. I was surprised. You know, I always heard that Palestinians were well-educated people, but it seemed like the number of of teenagers I met that were in university, every teenager I met was going to school. It was really great to see. So that was.
Is the university in the territory, or where are they? Where do they go to school?
So there's Hebron University. There's Beirut.
Beirut, which is near Ramallah.
There's Arab American University, right?
There's also the Bethlehem University.
Bethlehem,
run by the Christian Brothers, actually. Oh. Yeah, so there's several little places of education.
How does the economy work? I mean, because it's in such a weird situation, you know, how do you run an economy like that? It must be very difficult.
I would assume that it's extremely difficult, and they suffer a great deal as a result. I think education is their only weapon, you know. That's that's why so many of the young people really strive to do their best and to get their degrees, and many of them leave and hope to come back and make, you know, be effective in their communities. But, you know, it's difficult when you're a farmer and you have to go through a checkpoint to sell your tomatoes to the next town, which is just a couple of miles down the road, and you have to wait and, you know, your produce in the sun, what a lot of Americans don't realize is that the checkpoints are not in Israel. They are in the West Bank. So the Israeli military is setting up, you know, over 200 checkpoints just to make life difficult for these poor people. You know, kids going to school in the morning have to go through a checkpoint. What is the meaning of that? Yeah. What is the purpose of that? Except to make their lives miserable so they can say, I've had enough, I'm leaving, you know. And a lot of people do. You know, anyone who has the means or the connection will leave. Because, you know, if you're a parent, you know, like I am, and, you know, we want the best for our children. Right. You know, that's why my parents left in 1948. You know, they never thought that things would never get better. But, you know, they wanted a life for their children.
Right.
And unfortunately, a lot of people, it's very, very difficult for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's unnecessary. It's unnecessary.
Well, I suppose that's it. You know. I suppose Israel, the government, most probably creates that. I mean, so it keeps everyone so busy just complying with those things that they don't have time to really do anything else.
In order to get to work, you know, all the energy, if you're lucky enough to have a job,
right?
Just all the energy that it takes, or in order to get to school. You know, are you going to meet, soldiers who will throw something at you? Or living under occupation is not fun.
Right.
It's just not fun.
Yes.
I was coming back from Ramallah into Jerusalem, and I was on a shared taxi, which is like a big taxi that a lot of people ride in so that it's inexpensive. And I was sitting next to a Palestinian woman who was a TV camera woman, and they stopped, what happens, you stop at the checkpoint and the soldiers come on and they check everybody's ID, and she'd forgotten her ID, and she's saying to me, I forgot my ID. Well, as it turned out, they didn't check hers, but she was just going to work. And she was in such a panic. And I remember what she said to me. She said, "Oh, are you German?" And I guess that was a compliment. I mean, you couldn't be an American, right? I thought, do I look German now? It was, she made it through that day. But the panic, just to simply get to work.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. That's what gets you when you can't just live your life like what we expect to be able to do, you know, unfettered and not even to be able to have to think about it.
Yeah,
their lives are full of that every day, all day. They are dealing with that. That's psychologically, what is happening in people's heads just psychologically.
Yes,
Lois was mentioning the Sharon's house in the middle of the Muslim quarter. I wasn't sure what it was when I first saw it. I knew it was a settlement because there were Israeli flags all over it, but it was almost too big to be like a house. So I had just finished lunch, and I was kind of hanging out outside this restaurant, and I asked this Palestinian guy smoking a cigarette, as they all do, except for Therese. And
I don't smoke.
Yeah, I had a few cigarettes while I was there. Yeah, and I asked the man, you know, what is that? Is it because? He didn't know what to say to me because he didn't know if I was, you know. He's afraid to speak the truth.
Right.
He said, it's a school, you know. It's and you could see the fear about even talking about this, you know, this place right in the middle of his town.
Right.
And he couldn't even say what it was to someone on the street. You know, the fear is just, and I saw that in several, I saw it in people that were scared to go to demonstrations for fear that they'd be thrown in prison for 2 years.
Wow.
That were scared to talk to me because, you know, for all they knew, I was a, you know, informant for the
right
Israelis. So
a lot of fear.
A lot of fear.
A lot of fear.
To speak the truth.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, oh, in fact, a lot of fear. My time is running out on my show, in fact. Well, thank you, Therese Woolworth, Deppin Weber, and Lois Perlman.
You're welcome.
And, you are welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I think hopefully everyone's learned a bit and can really get some understanding about what's happening in a situation that just has to be resolved. It's been too long.
I hope you get some good responses.
We hope so. Well, thank you very much for coming in.
There's an APAC convention December 14th at the Fairmont in San Francisco, and it would be great for everyone to come down there and tell them they're not welcome in these parts.
That's good.
Where's that going to be, and you know what time?
I know it's December 14th. I'm thinking like early evening.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the Fairmont.
At the Fairmont.
Yeah.
San Francisco.
Good. Yeah. Look on the internet. Well, thank you. This is Arnaldi, a host of Tommy's Holiday Camp, giving up my space to Miss Annie, who's coming in with a soul and R&B show, which is fabulous. And keep listening to Cows Radio, 107.3 FM. There we go.